This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. Each week, we dive into crime stories reported by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the nation. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. A case that people thought was closed, the Murdaugh murders case in South Carolina, was turned on its head this week. A judge overturned the convictions of Richard Alexander Murdaugh, known as Alex Murdaugh, for allegedly killing his wife and son. The judge also ordered a new trial. Murdaugh, an attorney himself, was from a prominent legal family in South Carolina. The case has attracted significant media attention, from podcasts and books to a Hulu series. In this roundup, we'll hear some reactions to the latest news, and we'll get some background on the Murdaugh case, including why that judge decided to overturn Alex Murdaugh's convictions. While the Murdaugh case has made plenty of headlines this week, you may have missed an update to another high-profile case, the 2024 Kansas City Super Bowl parade shooting. Two men convicted of the shooting recently went free. That's another story that we'll hear about in this roundup, as well as the latest development in the Tanner Horner case out of Texas. Later, we'll hear about a mass shooting that has been linked to artificial intelligence, ongoing efforts in Buffalo, New York to heal from the 2022 Tops supermarket mass shooting, and a new program in Minnesota aimed at reducing fatal shootings. First, we have some quick crime report roundups from around the country, starting with two crimes covered by Odyssey station 1010 Winds in New York City.
A strap hanger is fighting for his life at this hour after he was stabbed at an East Harlem subway station. Cops say the stabbing happened at about 1:15 p.m. on the downtown 6 train platform at the 125th Street station. The victim is said to be critical. Police say two attackers fled the scene. So far, there have been no arrests. Charges have been upgraded against a Queens man accused of setting a fire that killed four people, including a three-year-old girl. Queens District Attorney Melinda Katz says Roman Amatila now faces first-degree murder charges in addition to second-degree murder and arson, a total of 37 counts. Katz says he set the fire at the base of the only stairwell exit from the upper floors of a Flushing building.
The sequence of events show someone who was angry and, you know, went to that building and then came back to start the fire, knowing that, you know, our allegations is that he knew that in the staircase, no one could get out.
In addition to the four people killed, seven others were injured, including two firefighters. The upgraded charges mean Amatila could be sentenced to life behind bars if convicted.
Odyssey station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia also covered multiple crimes this week, including this road rage incident that spiraled into violence.
A Philadelphia man under arrest accused of shooting at a driver in what police are calling a road rage incident in Bethlehem. Jamie Alexander Paramo Zamudio, taken into custody yesterday, charged with aggravated homicide and aggravated assault. It was early yesterday morning when authorities say he fired a handgun through a woman's windshield while he was stopped at a red light at the intersection of Linden Street and Johnston Drive. The woman wasn't hit, but suffered minor injuries from the shattered glass. Police say the bullet also missed her 15-year-old son, who was sitting in the passenger seat. It's not clear what led up to the shooting. Police say they identified Ramo Zamudio after reviewing footage of the incident from two nearby school buses. He now is being held at Northampton County Prison without bail.
While one teen narrowly avoided a bullet, another teen in the area was taken into custody, according to KYW.
A teenager who admitted to fatally shooting a man during a carjacking in South Philadelphia 3 years ago, sentenced to at least a decade behind bars, Here's KYW's crime and justice reporter, Christian Johansson.
Rashid Banks Jr. was 15 years old when he shot and killed 50-year-old Michael Salerno in July of 2023 over his Pontiac sedan. Banks pleaded guilty in February to third-degree murder, conspiracy, robbery of a motor vehicle, and a gun offense. Three other firearms charges were dropped. Police say Banks was one of three armed suspects who jumped out of a red Kia Soul and tried to steal the car at 11th and Porter. They say Salerno, who had a friend in the car at the time, was trying to protect her and fought back when he shot. Judge Charles Ehrlich sentenced the now 17-year-old Banks to 10 to 25 years behind bars. The other two suspects were never arrested.
KYW also reported on a tragic firearm incident that officials believe was an accident. It claimed the life of an elementary school student this week.
A student in the Upper Darby School District in Delaware County has died in what officials believe was a case of accidental gunfire. Here's KYW's Vic Ragupathy.
Upper Darby School District Superintendent says Thursday afternoon a student was shot inside their home. While Upper Darby police are still investigating the incident, authorities believe the shooting was the result of children playing with a gun. The school district is working with police as they look further into the incident, and officials say they will provide updates as they become available. Adam Garber is the CEO of Ceasefire PA, an anti-gun violence advocacy group. He says if you have a gun in the home, keeping it locked away is paramount.
You don't want any unauthorized individual, especially a child, getting access to that firearm. The American Academy of Pediatrics and experts recommend always securing your firearm, ideally unloaded.
Options include getting a lockbox or a cable lock that will prevent your gun from firing. The Upper Darby superintendent shared resources with parents about discussing the consequences of playing with guns and the grieving process after violent events. There will also be professionals available at Beverly Hills Middle School Friday to lend support to anyone who needs it.
In Dallas, Texas, Odyssey station KRLD 1080 provided a report on the search in Everman, Texas, for Noel Alvarez, a child last seen more than 3 years ago. Here's KRLD reporter Austin York.
This is the latest in several attempts to find the remains at that location. Everman police confirmed the search is linked to the little boy's disappearance, but say no new leads or information brought them back to the house. The six-year-old was last seen alive in the fall of 2022. However, police were not made aware of his disappearance until the following year. His mother, Cindy Rodriguez Singh, was charged with his murder, but took off to India with her other kids before she could be taken into custody. Last year, she was extradited back to Texas to stand trial, but a judge has ruled her incompetent and ordered her held at a state mental facility. Noelle is presumed dead.
KRLD also provided an update on the Tanner Horner case. The station has been following the trial for this former FedEx driver who pleaded guilty to the murder of 7-year-old Athena Strand. She was killed in 2022.
Tanner Horner sentenced to death in Fort Worth for killing 7-year-old Athena Strand, and he's now appealing his sentence. He pleaded guilty to killing the little girl at the start of his trial, and jurors for weeks heard difficult testimony as they had to decide whether he should die or spend the rest of his life behind bars. Jurors deliberated less than 3 hours when they made their decision, and now his attorneys have filed an appeal with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. If they affirm the sentence, they can go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Kansas City, Missouri was in a great mood on Valentine's Day 2024. There was this huge parade celebrating the Super Bowl win of the Kansas City Chiefs. And the weather, it was unseasonably nice. Families and friends were gathered near Union Station to enjoy the festive atmosphere. Then, amid the joy and the confetti, pops of gunfire could be heard. As shots rang out, more than 20 people were hit. One of them, radio host Lisa Lopez Galvan, died. Others were left injured, including children. Terry Young and Dominic Miller were both found guilty of unlawful use of a weapon after initially facing higher charges connected to the parade shooting. Both were sentenced to 2 years in the Missouri Department of Corrections, but both of them have been released as of this week, according to reports. The Dana and Parks Show, out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City, discussed the case this week. Let's listen.
Are you ready to get upset?
Oh, don't do this to me. Why?
From the Kansas City Star.
I already know what you're going to say before you say it.
Two men accused of firing shots in the mass shooting at the 2024 Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl victory rally that left one woman dead have been released.
You mispronounced murderers.
Have been released from prison.
Alleged.
After short stints in state custody. Both men, Dominic Miller and Terry Young, faced murder charges and pleaded guilty to lesser gun charges in March and April.
Idiots.
And received 2-year prison sentence.
How do you kill a woman? Bullets are flying at the Chiefs parade. Families are separated, screaming. People are injured trying to flee in the melee.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, you're just out somewhere back on the streets of Kansas City?
Yeah.
Can you not say when something like this happens that as part of your parole, we don't want you anywhere near our town? Go find another town.
Both pleaded guilty to an unlawful use of a weapon charge.
Unbelievable.
Why not put them up on murder?
Oh, God, it makes me mad.
I don't understand. And I guess I understand it from like a political perspective, if that's the way we want to go with it. I don't want to go politics here, but this whole stand your ground kerfuffle in the state of Missouri, It all comes down to an interpretation of the law. So, yes, I understand
it's
that a certain
crap
number.
Law.
I understand that a certain number of prosecutors are leaning on this one interpretation from this one Supreme Court decision regarding the stand your ground laws about one case that happened in St. Louis. However, we then ask a jury of 12 people, the peers of the people accused of committing the crime, whether or not they committed the crime based on their interpretation
but
of the
Sam,
law.
But Sam, there's no wiggle room with that. I will remind you, the case in St. Louis was one woman saying to another woman, I'm going to womp you. It was a W word that means smacking.
Right. Mollywalk.
I'm going mollywalk you. Mm-hmm. The other woman then said, well, I'm going to stab you. And the Missouri Supreme Court found that the way this crap law is written, the stand your ground law, that just the act of saying, excuse me, ma'am, I'm now going to mollywalk you, is enough that the crazy lady number two has every right to stab her.
What does mollywalk even mean?
It means knock out with one punch. But again, Dana, I think that we're leaning too far onto this interpretation. And if I don't know what the drive is behind it. Deep down inside, I feel like they're trying to get the law tightened up, and this is their way of doing it.
But there are prosecutors who are Republicans, and there are prosecutors who are Democrats, and they're all screaming about the same crap law.
Okay, but that's still, we can still put it before a jury and let them decide.
Boom, and go with the lesser included.
We can still charge them. We're just not going to charge them.
Well,
something else is going on.
The problem is, on paper, this seemed like a decent law. The lawmakers are like, ooh, look, we love gun rights. What it really comes down to is, if I'm shooting at you and I'm an idiot, and now you're shooting at me and you're an idiot, we both felt fear, who are you going to prosecute for that?
But why not take them to trial on a murder charge and include a lesser included
because
charge?
All they have to say is, I felt in fear of my life. He was shooting at me. I shot at him. We both felt fear. End of story. Can't go to... They have to rework the law.
But you killed an innocent person.
That's absolutely right.
So in that scenario, you take it to trial. Worst case scenario, they get the same charges they walked away with. Best case scenario for the public, they go to jail for murder.
Absolute travesty.
Lindell Mays, another man charged in connection with the Kansas City Super Bowl parade shooting, still faces charges of second-degree murder, armed criminal action, unlawful use of a weapon, and causing a catastrophe, according to KCTV. His trial is set to begin next March. In 2023, the trial of South Carolina attorney Alex Murdaugh resulted in convictions for the murders of his wife and son, and eventually 2 life sentences. Those convictions were overturned this week. Here's Tara Servatius of Odyssey Station 98.9 Word FM in Greenville, South Carolina, discussing the news.
It's truly one of the most stunning cases I've ever seen. I mean, for the clerk of court, Becky Hill, who, by the way, is now the convicted clerk of court, criminally convicted clerk of court, to tell the jury, that guy Murdaugh, don't listen to what he says. He's not very credible. He's probably lying. Dang, girl. What were you thinking? Even the jurors were stunned. And of course, she was thinking she'd write a book and wanted a certain outcome. And, you know, I didn't think much of basically turning the jury, Lee, into, part of the story. It's just legally you can't do that. And she would have known that. I don't know how she thought she's going to get away with this. Nobody will say anything.
Before we dive further into new developments, including a new trial for Murdaugh, let's get some background about that original trial. This is audio from March 2023, when anchor Pat Thurston of Odyssey station KCBS Radio in San Francisco spoke with David Katz, a former federal prosecutor who's also worked as a defense attorney in Beverly Hills, about the Murdaugh convictions.
20 months ago, the wife and son of a highly influential attorney in South Carolina were shot to death on the family's vast property near the dog kennels. Alex Murdaugh claimed he was nowhere near the kennels when his family members were murdered. He was proved a liar when a video was presented taken by his son that showed he was at the kennels just before they were shot. Alex lied about a lot of things in the case. He admitted opioid addiction, admitted on the stand to his addiction, to his financial crimes, and to lying to investigators trying to find the killer. But there was no physical evidence connecting him to the crime. The defense seemed to rest their argument on that more than anything else. The jury has found Alex Murdaugh guilty of killing his family members. Were you surprised at the verdict?
I wasn't surprised at the verdict, Pat, but I was surprised at how quickly it was returned. I think a lot of people were. I think a lot of stations and media got kind of invested in, you know, it was close, like a ball game that you want to be close. And in my judgment, it really wasn't close because of what you said, that after he had this false alibi narrative, after he'd said he was nowhere near the scene of the shootings of his wife and his own son, he was undone by this very short video that was taken by the son who was killed. And it took about a year to get it off of the, you know, security system that's put on the Apple device. Mm-hmm. But the police and the prosecution were very persistent. They got it. And once they got it, it undid the whole story that Alex Murdaugh had been telling, that he was nowhere near the scene of the shootings. It put him at the scene of the shootings just 5 minutes before they happened. And had he really left, none of this made any sense because he would have heard shotgun blasts. They're right. Very, very loud. So they would have called his attention, and he never returned, according to him, to the scene until much later. But as I say, he wouldn't even have taken the stand. He wouldn't have had to sort of tell this utterly, to me, improbable story had it not been that the police and the prosecution were persistent at getting that piece of evidence, that crucial piece of evidence, that minute-long video. They called two witnesses who identified his voice. Once that put him there, I think he felt that he had no choice as a seasoned trial lawyer himself but to take the stand and to try to, you know, just go for broke, and that failed. And I don't think any of the appeals will end up succeeding either. I think he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. We'll know what his sentence is tomorrow morning. The judge will sentence him tomorrow morning, I suspect, to life without parole.
You know, one of the things, and I didn't watch this trial start to finish, as I've done with a lot of trials you and I have spoken about, but one of the things that I did see that bothered me was evidence that showed that after he knew that his wife and son had been murdered like this, he didn't call family members, the people who were closest, the people who would care the most about these deaths. But he was making phone calls. He was making phone calls to other people. He was calling friends. He was calling business associates. That, to me, made me believe that he didn't care, that he didn't care about what happened, and that he wasn't thinking about, oh, my God, how am I going to break the news to so-and-so? What did you think of that testimony?
He came across to me as an utter egomaniac, a person who was totally self-involved, arrogant. He was from this legal dynasty down there. You know, it might have been a small pond, but they were the big fishes there for over 100 years. They'd controlled the prosecutor's office. You know, their word was kind of a big deal down there. And things started to unravel for him, too, with his 19-year-old son, the one who ended up being shot to death. He'd been in a boat accident. And, of course, one of the sub-themes of this whole thing, and he admitted this on the stand, was that Murdaugh was a liar. He was an embezzler. He looked people right in the eye and stole their money. He said, I'm going to get a big recovery for you. And then he absconded with the money. He said that was to feed his opioid addiction, which also didn't make a whole lot of sense. In the course of that, he ended up opening the door to the fact that he had had somebody shoot him, and he had actually been shot. But apparently he wasn't injured that much, but he opened the door to the fact that he had actually had somebody shoot him. I guess that was a client who was also like a distant cousin. So the whole thing ended up being terrible, and he had to say on the stand, as he did repeatedly, that I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, but I'm not a murderer. And I think that what he thought, talking about the arrogance point, the egomaniacal part of him, is he really was one of those people, I think, who thought he could commit the perfect crime. The reason was he was going to cover up all the financial machinations, and he did manage to delay several probes into his stealing and embezzlement. And I think that he actually thought through that it will be so outlandish that anyone kill their own wife and their own son that they'll never think that that was I could have had that motive, and the jury will ultimately acquit me. Well, the prosecutor had the last laugh, if you want to call that, because it was 2.5 hours. It was shorter than the OJ verdict. Yeah. And I have to tell you this in case you haven't seen it. OJ actually called in to opine on the verdict.
No, he didn't.
He did. It's on every news station. It's on every TV station. And yes, and the satirists are saying, you know, if Murdoch didn't do this, maybe OJ did.
Maybe he found the real killer after all.
They're all looking for the real killers. They're all looking for the real killers down in South Carolina on that huge estate who happened to kill his wife and son 5 minutes after he left them alive.
Yeah, David Katz. So in a horrible, tragic case like this, you've left me laughing.
By September 2023, Murdaugh's attorneys were requesting a retrial, citing interference. Eric Thomas and Maggie Schaefer of KCBS spoke with Bruce Green, a law professor at Fordham University who specializes in criminal law and procedure, about the case and about legal ethics at the time.
Attorneys for Alex Murdoch are vying for a retrial, saying the clerk of the court had a hand in influencing the jury. The clerk apparently rushed jurors to a decision and even made up a story to get one dismissed, as well as going on a book tour about the case after it closed down, all bringing up ethical, legal, and other questions surrounding the trial. So I've covered a few hundred trials in my time. In most cases, you never even notice the clerk. So what does the clerk normally do?
Normally, the clerk brings the jurors in and out of the courtroom, makes sure that they're comfortable, arranges for them to have meals if they're being transported somewhere, arranges that. It's a ministerial job and has nothing to do with the adjudication of guilt or innocence.
So what in this case would you describe as unethical?
Well, I can only talk about the allegations. And,
allegations,
so far,
exactly.
You know, the allegation is that the clerk of the court talked about the substance of the case with some of the jurors and basically stated or implied that Murdoch should not be believed before he testified, allegedly. She told one of the jurors or the jury in general to watch him closely and look at his actions and his movements, implying that he was going to be lying. And then allegedly she pressured the jury to rush its verdict by not allowing the smokers on the jury to have a cigarette break and suggesting that they weren't going to be allowed to go home for the night if they didn't reach a verdict. And then there's some allegations that she also had secret communications with the jury foreperson, for a foreperson did not submit an affidavit, so we don't know, whether that's true and B, what they talked about, but the implication was that they were talking about the substance of the case. So basically, you know, during a jury trial, the jury is not supposed to, deliberate until after they've gotten the trial completed and gotten the jury instructions from the judge, and B, they're not allowed to talk to anybody outside the jury about the substance of the case. And so certainly they're not allowed to have, a friend or neighbor or the court clerk talk to them about the case, much less, try to persuade them about who's telling the truth or not. So these are pretty, they're just allegations that we haven't heard from the clerk. The There's just, an affidavit from a juror. They haven't, the jurors haven't testified or spoken to the judge about what they observed. So it's really just at a very early stage. But if these allegations turn out to be true, then it really jeopardizes the verdict.
Indeed, it jeopardizes the verdict because, if a judge clearly tells the jurors unambiguously that you can't talk about the case, then officers of the court and clerks of the court know that they can't have anything to do with that either.
That's absolutely right. And, there's not a lot of case law about this because these things don't happen very often. The leading Supreme Court case goes back to 1954, so that's, almost three quarters of a century old. And it's a very short opinion that basically just says, if somebody, a third person was communicating with the jury about the substance of the case, it's presumptively prejudicial, presumptively reversible error. And unless a court finds that the error was harmless, you have to go back and try the case again. I don't know how you would find this was harmless if in fact it occurred. So I think the $64,000 question is whether these conversations, really took place.
If it's true, it's a very expensive mistake, a potential retrial. So, but what's so odd is that this was such a high-profile case, right? Televised. we've seen it. I mean, does the defense team really think that it can get a different verdict?
Well, it was a circumstantial case, and nobody saw Murdoch kill his wife and son. And, I think it was an incredibly strong circumstantial case from what I've read. But maybe he's hopeful. And now that he's seen the prosecution's evidence, maybe he feels that there's a better way strategically to address the case. It also gives him hope. And there's no downside, to appealing and reversing the conviction and trying again.
Well, let me ask you this. We have about 45 seconds left. The case was already, as Margie mentioned, high profile. If you have it reversed because of something as, flashy as this, then how do you find an impartial jury after this?
Well, that is an amazing thing, but it's not that the jury has to have no knowledge. It's that the jurors have to be able to say truthfully that they'll put aside what they've read and learned about the case from other sources and make the draw just on the evidence in the case and reaching their verdict. So I don't think, there have been lots of high-profile cases over history, and judges manage to find jurors who say they could put aside what they've read and decide based on the evidence.
In Greenville this week, Tara Servatius asked news director Lee Rogers what he thought of the judge's move to overturn Murdaugh's convictions.
It's not just the clerk of court, but it is also the judge that was involved in the case. And this honestly did not surprise me.
Me either.
Because we've known for a long time that, she was making these comments, that she'd spoken to the jury, said things that should not have been said. So this didn't surprise me a bit.
Even though Murdaugh's murder convictions have been overturned, he still has sentences for federal financial crimes to serve. In April 2024, the U.S. Department of Justice announced that Murdaugh had been sentenced to 40 years in prison for those financial crimes. Next up, we'll be hearing about a mass shooting that's been linked to AI and more. Before allegedly shooting 5 children dead at a secondary school in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, and injuring others, 18-year-old Jessie Van Rootselaar also allegedly shot and killed her mother and her half-brother at her home, according to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The teen later died of a self-inflicted injury. Van Rootselaar was using OpenAI's artificial intelligence-powered chatbot, ChatGPT, before the shooting. The CBC reported that her account had been banned for, quote, disturbing content, and law firm Rice Parsons Leone and Elliott claims that 12 different OpenAI employees asked the company to warn Canadian law enforcement about her. Now, the firm is suing OpenAI in California. Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo Discuss the case with crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett this week.
And we're taking a look at what we keep hearing more and more of, Brad, and that is AI, ChatGPT, some of these other artificial intelligence programs being used in, or at least being looked at before a crime happens or may have happened. And we're all kind of wondering, well, shouldn't this raise a red flag? What can we do about it? What do we know about this, Brad?
So if you think about the number of people that say bad things and maybe facilitate or try to facilitate AI to help them, you know, I don't know how big that number would be. You would think if somebody goes on AI, says, I want to shoot up my school, and then the AI helps them figure out what's the best type of weapon, when's the best time to go to school, how to get to school, how to exit the school, and maybe even help you write a manifesto, you would think, obviously, that's a huge red flag. The question is, there's a lot of AI companies. We know about the big ones, like OpenAI, that I think I discussed in my pitch, that they're being sued by some folks in the British Columbia because of a mass shooting there. there's a real issue about where the AI companies can draw a line. The example I just gave, you'd think that would be a no-brainer, but you also have to have the mechanism to do that. I mean, they're trying to monitor, like, potentially millions of people at the same time. You know, and they primarily do that with algorithms, not listening to what people or reading what people are writing or whatever it might be. But, you know, it's a pretty daunting task. But having said that, is it worth not doing it and then getting sued? And clearly it's a judgment call, I think, to a certain extent by the AI companies as to, does this really meet a threshold, or is this person just talking talk? It's a tough call, I think, sometimes. But don't be surprised if you see more and more of these lawsuits where people are alleging that AI could have stopped a potential shooter and didn't.
But do we know if AI, being so intelligent, if AI could stop the shooters before they opened fire?
Well, the short answer is no, you can't stop a person from doing whatever they're going to do, but you can certainly not facilitate or help them do what they are saying they want to do. So I think the question you're asking me is AI, the contributor, the motivator? It's really hard to say. I mean, logic would say in some cases it appears to be the case, but can you say that for sure? The answer is no. If you're determined to commit a mass shooting, obviously we had plenty of mass shootings before there was AI. And people find, you know, websites, they find individuals, they find groups to help legitimize / rationalize what they want to go do. So all I'm suggesting is we do need to figure out better ways to monitor to stop some, it would appear to be pretty obvious, would-be mass shooters.
There's two things to this, Brad. There's one, what you just mentioned, monitoring this. I mean, you'd think it should be easy enough to throw up a red flag. But then the other is the programming here, and thinking specifically of ChatGPT, where, I mean, it constantly, and, you know, we could be talking about a shooter or we could be talking about something else here. It constantly is validating people who are putting things into it. It's constantly, you know, encouraging people, offering words of encouragement. It seems like a programming or design flaw, or maybe it's on purpose, you know, we don't really know, where it's just, you know, it's acting like your best friend, you know, your cheerleader in the corner, no matter if you're trying to drop 10 pounds or do something heinous.
So you've hit a direct point that is what it does. But that's why people use it. You don't want to go on a website that then beats you up because, well, you don't want to do that. You know, what's wrong with you? They want a soft, compassionate, literate voice that guides them through depression, relationship issues, whatever it might be. And so, you know, there's a real attraction to that, which then does two things. It A, attracts more people, and B, it attracts you to go use it more. And the last thing they need is to be hard-nosed on the front end, so to speak, because people will just go someplace else because there's a lot of competition now within the AI world.
You know, we're today remembering the Tops mass shooting here in Buffalo took 10 lives 4 years ago today. And there are lawsuits in this case against social media companies for influencing the shooter. But, you know, what the cases have in common with what you're talking about with AI is that outside factors figure in many of these attacks, right?
Well, that's right. And I assume the lawyers for the AI companies will point that out, and rightly so. We'll see. But, you know, don't be surprised if you see more lawsuits as time goes on, because it's a logical, rational place if you're a would-be shooter to go to help you figure out how to best commit this horrible act.
In Buffalo, WBEN has covered the impact of a mass shooting, the 2022 Tops supermarket massacre, for years. Then 18-year-old Peyton Gendron allegedly shot 13 people, killing 10. A manifesto from Gendron indicated that it was a racially motivated attack. 11 of the 13 victims were Black. And research has connected the case to online radicalization. Thursday marked the 4-year anniversary of the massacre, and Gendron is still awaiting a federal trial with a possible death penalty. Meanwhile, the community is still healing from the loss. Reverend Mark Blue, chair of the 514 Memorial Commission, provided an update on those efforts to heal the community in an interview with WBEN this week.
How are you remembering today?
Well, I'm remembering today as a day, not only a somber day, but also a day in which progress is being made on the 514 Memorial Healing Center. We are sending out all of our prayers to all of the families, and not only the families of those lives that were stolen from us, but also the survivors, the individuals that were in the Tops and in the surrounding area. It's going to be a day in which we will always remember for the rest of our lives, but we want to just be encouraging to those families and letting them have their moment of grief and not try to put more on them. So we are remembering this as a somber occasion, but also an occasion in which we have learned to persevere through.
Reverend, many people are taking part in a day of service today. Many will be at the remembrance at 2:00 this afternoon at the Tops store. But for those not going to be there, what do you want them to do today or to think about?
Take time for themselves, because everybody's healing process is different. Their grieving process is different. Take time for yourself. Have that moment of reflection, which we will always have, but it's, self-maintenance is very important. We need to take time for ourselves. We don't do that enough. This time, this day has always been full of activities, but for those who are going through and grieving, take time for yourself. Take time with your family. Enjoy your family.
You mentioned that there is progress being made on the 514 Memorial. There's a lot of questions as to, you know, what exactly is being done there and where this process is. What can you tell us about what happened this week?
Well, this week we did hire a construction manager, and the construction manager will help us to really get the accurate estimates as and timetable for when the Monument Memorial Healing Center can be built. We'll have more actual and real numbers that we can give out to the community, so they'll know exactly how much it will cost for this to happen. And we're looking at roughly about, and maybe within the next 2 to 3 months, we will have another update on real cost. And also, we are in the soft phase of our capital campaign. So it's moving quite rapidly compared to other memorials and that have been done. We have had the advantage, and I say that not happily, but I say we've had the advantage of looking at what others have done and not duplicating some of the errors or mistakes or pitfalls that they ran into, because we've been talking to them. And by having that communication, we were able to move at a much more rapid pace because, unfortunately, of the tragedies that has happened in our past in our country.
This memorial will be built at Jefferson and Best, and I realize you don't have the true cost of it, but how much money has been raised, and what is the goal right now?
Well, the goal is to raise as much money as we can, but right now we have about $7 to $8 million that has been committed to the project, and we are hoping to raise another 15 to 20 million, because we would like for this not only to be done one time, but to be maintained and taken care of in forever and perpetuity. So, you know, it's a fundraising venture that will happen on a regular basis, because we want to make sure that our community is being serviced and that it's not just a one-time incident of a building being done and then forgot about. But, you know, we're trying to raise as much as we can to make sure that it is taken care of in perpetuity.
You know, we've reached the point now where it's been so long, there's been so many meetings, there's been so much money involved, that a lot of people are wondering, you know, hey, why haven't we just used this money for something else to better the community instead of this memorial project? You mentioned not just being a building. How, in your mind, is this memorial going to be a benefit to the surrounding community?
Well, it will be a place of solace, a place where people can heal, a place where people can reflect, a place where people can learn. We will be partnering with other organizations to have different services at this particular site on Jefferson and Best, which we haven't had in the past. It will be a place where even artists can show their works. So it's going to be a ever evolving place in which we can come and learn and come and receive any of the services that we need for the community. We're not trying to be a first. We're trying to bring other entities and other organizations together for healing. We also want this to be a place where even the schools can come and learn about what has happened and learn how we can be a vehicle and a pinnacle to teach that racism is learned behavior and it can be unlearned. So it's going to be a great place, not only locally, but I believe even internationally, people will come and see how we persevered and how we made a difference in our community to help eradicate racism and the prejudices that are in our society.
You know, Reverend Blue, you always say that you have one chance to get this right. With that said, are you satisfied with every decision that's been made so far?
Yes, I am, because it's heavily community involved. We're doing focus groups even currently right now. At the very beginning of this, we started by having the community share their input as to what needs to be done for our community, for healing, for our community, for uplifting. As you can see, a lot of things are happening on Jefferson right now, and community redevelopment. So it fits. This is going to be a place where people will want to come and want to share not only their experiences, but even have physical activity, even have yoga. There's a lot of unlimited possibilities in which we are still developing for this site and for this building. It will be used all year round. And one of the things that we need to do is to know that our children need this learning opportunity as well as our adults to help in the grieving process. So, you know, we are working with heavily community input as to what we're doing and going forward.
In Minnesota, authorities are taking a new approach towards reducing fatal shootings. It starts with investigating non-fatal shootings. Here's Ramsey County Attorney John Choi explaining this new program in an interview with Jason DeRusha of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities.
How does investigating non-deadly shootings lead to maybe answers in actual homicide?
Yeah, because I think that we're sending the wrong message if we don't solve these crimes. And then let's talk about why this was. A lot of times, you know, in our communities, we have retaliatory violence, cyclical violence. So when the police officer shows up to the emergency room and the person is recovering from their gunshots, they don't want to participate in their own investigation and prosecution.
Because it's gang, it's like gang stuff where somebody...
Yeah, retaliatory violence, and they don't believe that the system is going to keep them safe, and so it's better for them keep themselves safe and then exact whatever revenge they're going to do. So this just perpetuates, especially in urban jurisdictions all across America. But if we were to take an approach to say that we're going to investigate and prosecute these cases regardless of whether or not the victim participates, and by the way, we do that all the time for a homicide, right? There is no victim. We figure out how to solve these cases so we can do the same thing for these cases. And so the effort and the initiative is just to really treat these cases like a homicide. The St. Paul police created their own separate unit, not the homicide unit. It's a separate non-fatal shooting unit. They go out immediately as soon as there are shots fired. And then we also created a victim a witness emergency fund and the theory of change there is that if we could take care of some of the basic needs of individuals around safety, maybe later they will participate. But we're assuming that they're not going to participate. And we're developing and getting all of the evidence that you can get, like cell phone location, video cameras, all of those things. And we're just on it right away and treat them like a homicide. And that's why these results,
the response is sort of the same, right, John? Like the police department sends out the same kind of cavalry that they would if it...
Yep.
Now, in St. Paul, there were only 15 homicides, right? So does that make it more
think
doable?
About the year before. But think about the year before.
More,
there were 32.
Right?
32 homicides, and then we got it down to 15, and I know it's because of this. I mean, just the shots fired in our town, I mean, it went down from 183 to 73.
Yeah.
In terms of non-fatal shootings.
The results are unbelievable. Are they better than you expected?
Yeah, we were just thinking if we could get it over 50% because our model was Denver, and they got it up to 50% after a year. We thought we'd be doing great, and wow, we're at like above 70%, and we've been doing that for the last 2 years.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, KRLD 1080 in Dallas, the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, the Tara Show out of 98.9 Word in Greenville, South Carolina, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, and WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.